John chapter 6, if you would, this morning, please. John chapter 6. I find it kind of humorous at times how things break down. Maybe it's just because I break them down, but this one, we have probably the shortest passage in our study of the book of John, just 5 verses, and then we're going to look at probably the longest passage, or at least one of the longest passages in our study of the book of John as we come to the end of this passage. John 6, we're right in the middle of Jesus performing his signs before the crowds, for the people. Some are seeing the signs and believing, and some are not, because they don't believe because they don't see. We're going to reach that climax in the book in just a few chapters, up in chapter 9, where the blind man is healed, and Jesus says, listen, I've come so that those who are blind might see, and so that those who think they can see might realize their blindness. John chapter 6, he's still in the middle of performing his signs. People are responding to his signs, and they've just responded as well as they could. We're actually going to pick up this text with the last verse of what we looked at last week. Verse 15 in John chapter 6. After Jesus fed the multitudes, he broke the bread. They gathered up 12 baskets full of bread, leftovers. Verse 15 says, so they gathered them up. Or that was 13. Verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea. Got into a boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat. They were frightened. But he said to them, it is I. Do not be afraid. Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. You could have probably told the story and probably not left out any, or at least many of the details, because there's not a lot to leave out. That's what we're working with this morning. Well, I want to pick up this morning with just a little bit of review last week. Last week we talked about how that Jesus will not be the king that we want him to be. Oftentimes we treat God, or Jesus, who is God, but we approach God in that way of, if we can just coerce him in just the right way, we can manipulate him, we give God what he wants, we'll stick the quarter of good works, we'll stick the quarter of prayer, we'll stick the whatever in to give God what he wants, and then when we turn the crank, then we'll find that he gives us what we want. And we talked about how when we treat God in that way, acknowledging him to be king so that I get what I want really makes me king, right? And as the crowds have come to Jesus, they're not asking him for bread, but he gives them bread. And as Jesus gives them bread, he gives them more bread than what they could eat. It says they took so much, they were all satisfied. They took as much as they were wanted. They took as much as they wanted, and they were satisfied. In fact, they took a little bit more than they could eat. They took everything they wanted, but they found that what they wanted was more than they could eat. And so Jesus passes the baskets. In fact, each of the disciples picks up a basket, goes around the crowd, and 12 baskets are filled with broken bits of food. There's more left over than when they started. What they just found was not just a gumball machine. They found an ATM that's open right next to the gumball machine. I can get all the money I want, put all the quarters I want, and get all the gumdrops that I want for the rest of my life. Jesus, you be king. Okay, this is great. We have got this figured out. And we see at the end of verse 15, Jesus says, no, that's not why I'm here. But as we look at this passage, I want us to note that last week, it was primarily concerned with the crowd. Verse 2, that was the focus. Jesus looks and here's the crowd. The crowd is coming to Jesus. The crowd wants to make Jesus king because the crowd is fed by Jesus. As we come to this narrative today, it exclusively deals with a different group. Verse 16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea and got into a boat. This is going to be a text not for the crowd at large. This is going to be done exclusively for the benefit of those who belong to him, who are with him, who are working for him. In fact, Luke tells us that just before the feeding of the 5,000, they'd been sent out, they'd been commissioned by Jesus to go out to preach and to teach and to heal. They've been given authority over demons, over sickness. They have been a part of what Jesus is doing in this kingdom mission from God. And it's these people in particular that Jesus is going to deal with in this passage in particular. And as we come to the text this morning, it's going to be the same truths that we looked at last week. Jesus refuses to be the king that you're looking for because he's teaching you to look for the king that he is. This was the story last week. Jesus refuses to be the king that you're looking for. Jesus will not be the sovereign that makes you sovereign. He will not be the one who receives glory by giving you glory over him. Jesus is sovereign. He's not going to be the king that you're looking for, but he is going to teach you to look for the king that he is. That's the second part of this whole story. Because as the disciples have just come off of successful ministry, they've gone out, they've preached, they've gone on, they cast out demons, they've gone, they've healed sick people, they've gone and they've done this work. Now they come back and Jesus kind of puts the cherry on the top of the whole thing. This is the one piece of information that's recorded in every single gospel. This is the high watermark of Jesus' ministry, this feeding of the 5,000. So we're going to look at how all of these dynamics are at work in these ones who are on Jesus' team, doing Jesus' work, glorifying Jesus' name, ready for Jesus to be king. God's going to do a work in them in particular. So as we come to this moment in the text, I want to establish for us our hermeneutic. How do we approach a text like this? And basically, we have two choices. The first choice is to say that this text is a text about the church. This is a text that talks about, this is the crowd or it's for the disciples. How do we interpret this text? This is a text for the church. That is, it's a text about us. Us as disciples, us as God's people. But this text is primarily about us. And at one level, we're not wrong when we say that. And several commentators approach it this way. I won't name their names. Just talk to me before you buy commentaries on the book of John. This one says, I offer a typical interpretation. That is an interpretation of a type. He says, the incident of Christ going up on the mountain to pray gives us a glimpse of our ascended interceding Savior, our living advocate with the Father. And we shall not be surprised if we find some representation of the church doing that during that advocacy. The sea in Scripture is often used as a symbol of the nations in all their restlessness and confusion. And into that very sea, our Lord sends his church. So the disciples represent the church. They go out in the sea into the nations. Another one says, the sea that night during which he is absent, the storm. These are all symbols of the present age. Like it was on that sea, so it is with this age. So we just take it and we kind of make a jump. This is talking about the church. Another one says, it'd be difficult to find a more telling picture of the church. Here is a small handful of people, seemingly remote from the land where most people live their lives, apparently irrelevant to the great issues confronting the world, tossed by the winds of secularism, controversy without, out of touch with its point of departure, unsure of its whereabouts, with no clear destination ahead. All the while, its members, like the disciples in the story, strain at the oars of good works and ministry, making no apparent headway in the process. Now, we are disciples of Jesus Christ. We are the church of Jesus Christ. And at one level, these applications are absolutely true. Okay? But this text isn't primarily about us. This text is what it's always been, primarily a text about Jesus Christ. And that's the point of this text. It brings it to an emphasis with an exclamation point. When Jesus shows up and he says, guess what, guys? I am. And what it does in the very middle of this whole story for us, it takes Jesus and equates him with God. And who God is affects the people of God of any age, whether it's the disciples who are functioning under Old Testament Mosaic law or those of us who are operating under New Covenant. Who God is meant to impact the people of God. It has to make a difference in your life. And so while it's not about us, it absolutely affects us and how we do life. That's the whole point of the story. It's for us, but it's about Jesus because it's about God. Does that make sense? So as we look at this story of the sea, it's a story about disciples, but it's a story about God. And what we're going to find out is that Jesus, in this context of wanting to be crowned king, or the crowds wanting to crown him king, he's going to offer a different kind of sovereignty. And the sovereignty that he offers is going to reflect the ways of the God that he represents. I'm sovereign, but I'm not that kind of sovereign. I'm this kind of sovereign. I'm sovereign in the way in which your Father is sovereign. So let's watch how this sovereignty of God in the person of Jesus starts to play out in the lives of his disciples, those that are for him, more importantly, those that he is for them. Okay, so this is where this is going this morning. So we're going to look at the start of the story. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the Sea to Capernaum, and it was now dark. And you can hear the organ play. Bum, 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 right? Okay, it was a dark and stormy night. This is where this goes. In this short story, it's always a good place to start for a story, right? It's a dark and stormy night. But as we watch this story play out, then we're going to see that Jesus is going to provide us, again, three movements that are going to reveal his sovereignty in the midst of this dark and stormy night. The first is this, in verses 15 through 18. He reveals his sovereignty by sending them to do discipleship alone. Now remember, what Jesus does here, he does as God. He does as the revelation of God. He does in the name of the Father. He's emphasized that back in chapter 5. Everything that I'm doing because I'm watching the Father doing it. Everything that I'm saying, I'm doing because the Father told me to say it. I'm doing what I'm doing because this is who your God is. I want you to see him through me. So what does Jesus do as the king who refuses to be king? He takes those who belong to them and he sends them off to do discipleship alone. And the greatest portion of this text, the longest part of it, from verses 15 down through 18, is spent helping us to crawl into the skin of these disciples. It's going to describe their condition. It's going to describe their fear. It's going to describe their toil. We are going to feel wet and sticky and scared and cold and bad. Why would our sovereigns do this to us? Why would he send us into the middle of this? Doesn't he know? Didn't he know what this was going to cost me? Have you ever been there? Have you ever been upset with God's sovereignty in your life? He's good, right? How come my good God would give me such a bad deal? Such a bad hand? How come I got to play this hand? I mean, I understand it if he's blind and he's the dealer, but he can see everything, and I'm on his team, and he's supposed to be on my team. How come God dealt me such a bad hand? And so for the most of this text, the point of the author, John, God, is to help us to crawl into the skin of these disciples because, like Sue said this morning, listen, that's me. That's me. These guys, that's me. Okay? It's not about you, but you're going to find yourself in this story as we watch God dealing with his people. So we see there that their journey is going to be long. Jesus is on the far side of the Lake of Galilee. He's on the east side over there just above Gergesa. And so this is probably the area that he fed the 5,000. And it says there, verse 17, they got in the boat and they started going across the sea to Capernaum. So Capernaum's up at the top, and he's going to send them from here to there. This is going to be about 4 to 5 miles. Other contexts say they were going to Bethsaida. It's right up in this. They're going from here up into here. So somewhere that area. So this is going to be about 4 to 5 miles. It's going to be a journey. It's going to be long. And they know that as they go, it's evening. So there's going to be probably some winds that are going to come down from the northwest, and they're going to flow down here, probably down this river valley. And so they're going to go against the wind. They know that. This is going to be 4 or 5 miles of whatever. It's just what you do. It's just what's in front of them. It's a relatively familiar route. It says they go down to the sea. Colin Cruz says, the fact that it was dark and the sea was rough probably did not really concern the disciples all that much. Some of them were professional fishermen, used to being out on the lake at night with strong winds and rough seas. Okay, so this again, it's just, they're not upset yet at this point. This is just what you do. This is what it means to be an adult. This is what it means to be a disciple. They are adulting at this point, to use the new verb of the year, right? This is just what it means. You put on your big boy pants and you get out there and you make the waves. Okay, so this is the start of the feel. But then we see that the timing is not exactly perfect. Up there in verse 16, evening came, it says, when evening came, the disciples went down to the sea. Now, there's two different time periods that are kind of specifically thought of by the Jews when they use the word evening. The first evening would be from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until sunset, whenever that was, whatever time of year. And it's a little bit farther south than we are, so it's a little more even. But 3 o'clock till dark time. Or till sunset, till the sun goes down. The next evening is from sunset, where the sun is down below the rim, to when it finally gets dark. So you notice that on either side of this lake here, we've got the Golan Heights, we've got Mount Hermon, we've got all these mountains over here. They're surrounded by mountains. The Sea of Galilee sits 600 feet below the Mediterranean Sea, below sea level. So it's down in a basin. So when the sun goes down, sunset, it's not going to yet be dark because, of course, sun's going to set a little bit earlier when you got mountains in the way, right? So that's what happened. So they're probably between that sunset and dark. Not just probably. We know that to be the case because what does it say up in verse 17? They got into the boat. They started across to Capernaum, and it's now dark. They get in, they start their journey, and sun's below the rim, it's behind the mountains, and as they start to go, it's not just evening, it's dark. So it's not perfect. I mean, you know where you're going when you can see it, but now you start to lose sight of it, and if you get bumped off course just a little bit, you got to remember, is it that fire or that fire? And they don't have the streetlights like we have today. So they're... It's not just perfect, but it's okay. They've been here. They've done this before. But then we see that they're alone. Go back and look at verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew to the mountain by himself. So Jesus, we're told in a couple other passages, he dismisses the crowd after the feeding of the 5,000. And he starts to go up on the mountain. We don't know exactly which one, but probably right up here above Gergesa. And he prays. And as he goes up to pray, the crowd is dismissed, and the disciples go across the sea over to Capernaum. And it says there in verse 17, it's now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. So maybe they went down to the shore, and it has this feeling. Again, we're told in other texts that Jesus sent them to go before him across the sea. But here, as John's presenting it, it seems like Jesus dismisses the crowd, goes up on the mountain. The guys kind of loiter down to the shore, and they're like, "Where's Jesus? Hey, Jesus coming? Jesus coming? This took us just a little while. We got stuff to put it back in the boat. Jesus coming yet? We got to go." They climb in and they go. And then we see that as they start to go by themselves without Jesus, that there's going to be a struggle out there on the lake. And this is what every one of us feels, this tension, right? So it says there at the end of, in verse 18, "Then the sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing." You want to enter into this just a little bit more. Mark chapter 6 and Matthew chapter 14 gives us a little more background on what's happening in these hours of laborious toil as the sea becomes rough and the strong wind is blowing. We see in Mark chapter 6, verse 48, it says, "They make headway painfully." So in order to get to where they're going, they're not just like putting up the sail and going, "Peter, a little more to the right." The wind isn't blowing them toward their destination. The wind is blowing against them. Go a little farther in the text. It says, verse 19, "They rowed for about 3 or 4 miles. So the wind is blowing. In fact, Mark 6 says the wind is blowing against them. It's blowing in their face. I don't know about you, but I work so much better when the wind is at my back. I can kind of pull my coat up, I can block my neck, and I can kind of do my work a little bit as long as I've got the wind at my back. When I have to work hard with the wind blowing in my face, I become unsanctified in a hurry. Okay? I am Mr. Irritated because I'm cold. It's blowing down my neck, and it's a storm, okay? It's not just wind. It's not just rough. There's going to be lightning later on because they're going to see Jesus walking on the water. You can't see anything at 3 o'clock in the morning if it's dark out. This is going to be a storm. There's going to be rain. You got wet blowing in your face. And not just from the rain. You got these stupid waves that are getting in your boat. They're splashing you. I like to be warm. I like to be dry. I do not like to be wet. I do not like to be cold. Okay, you start and get just a little bit of the feel of what's going on here. I don't think you do either. I don't think you like being cold and wet. The wind is blowing in their face. It's blowing against them. And they're rowing. They've got 12 guys in a boat. They don't have Jesus. They got 12 guys in a boat. They got to get 12 guys who are full grown across the sea. The wind is blowing against them. That means that they've got to get all of this weight. This is when you wish Peter took one less piece of bread, right, this afternoon. You have to eat a whole plate all by yourself. Wow. This is hard work.
I could recognize something else.
So they're pulling.
As the ancients, and in particular,
and it says, they're pulling till the fourth watch of the... This isn't in the text in John, in book of Mark, chapter 6, verse 48. It says it's about the fourth watch of the night. It moves us to 3 to 6 o'clock in the morning. 3, 4, 5 o'clock, right in there. They've been doing this for a while. It was evening. In fact, it was just after sunset. It was not dark. Sun's still up. It's a beautiful sunset over the Lake of Galilee. Woo. Here we go. Wind starts coming. Waves start sloshing. A little bit of rain starts happening. And now they're pulling. They're pulling. They're pulling. And for hours. What? Let's be generous. Let's say it gets dark at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock till 12 o'clock is how many hours? 4 hours. 4 o'clock till 3 o'clock is another 3 hours. They've been doing this for roughly 7 hours, maybe 8. So they've been pulling against the wind for about 8 hours in the dark. And in that amount of time, it says they've covered about 3.5 to 4 miles. I don't know. I don't do this for a living. I'm not a rower. I don't do boating. But it seems like a long way, but it's not as far as they've got to go, obviously. In fact, 3 or 4 miles is about halfway across the Sea of Galilee. It's about 7 miles at its widest point. 3.5 miles puts you dead center of the Sea of Galilee. Guess what? Guess where they're going to end up at the end of the story? They're going to end up in Gennesaret. 3.5 miles puts you right about there. To put it bluntly, life stinks right now. Okay? It stinks to be a disciple at this point in the story. But there's something that this text doesn't highlight. It's highlighted by other texts. The disciples are going where they're going. They find themselves where they find themselves because they've been sent on a mission. Listen to how Mark 6 presents this. Right after the 5,000 are fed, it says, "And immediately Jesus made his disciples get in the boat and go before him to the other side." Why are they where they find themselves? Because Jesus told them to go there. I don't know if you ever thought about it. I remember as a kid wondering how smart my mom was when she sent me on my bike to get 2 gallons of milk. This doesn't work, right? Didn't my mom know I was going to have 2 gallons of milk and I can't ride my bike? And that's kind of how this disciple, at least I would be, if I were one of these disciples. Jesus, I'm not in the middle of the lake at night in a storm because I wanted to be here. This was not my idea, God. I'm just reminding you about that. They are where they are because Jesus sent them to go there. Why would Jesus do this? Go back up to verse 15. "Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew and the disciples go down to the boat." But Jesus sends them down to the boat. In fact, Jesus tells them to get in the boat and take off in the boat, go across the lake in the boat. Why? Here's something about our sovereign king. Our sovereign king knew at this moment in their lives that a physical storm was more beneficial to their spiritual welfare than to be around people who wanted to make Jesus king for the wrong reasons. Jesus says, "You go. You've already got a taste of success when I sent you and you got the attaboys for preaching and casting out demons. And now you've come to the high watermark of my ministry. People are saying, 'Go, Jesus, go, Jesus. You're my disciples.' I don't want you to get caught up in the fervor of the 'Go, Jesus' team for the wrong reasons. I want you to know who I am, but I want you to understand what that means. Get in a boat. I know a storm's coming, but that's going to be safer for you than to follow Jesus for the wrong reasons." Is this starting to make sense? Is this starting to raise some questions? Well, shouldn't we just want to follow Jesus? We should. But it's more dangerous for us to follow Jesus for the wrong reasons than to toil on behalf of Jesus in obedience and find out our weakness. A lot of people follow Jesus in order so that they can be sovereign in their lives. As long as they stroke Jesus, give Jesus, pray to Jesus, obey Jesus, so that Jesus makes life comfortable, so that they can have their best life now. As long as Jesus gives blessing, then I'll follow Jesus. Jesus says, "Guys, I'm Jesus, I'm God, I'm King. It's more important for you to find out what kind of king I am. Go into the storm. Jesus, you're a bad king. If that's what it means to be a disciple, you're a bad king." Unless the king comes out in the storm and meets you and brings you to the other side safely, right? And that's exactly what he's going to do. But that's the tension. I love how Ron Hughes notes, there's two ways to get into storms. One is to flee God's will like Jonah did. Jonah says, no, God, I'm going this way. What does God do to get his attention? He says, Jonah, let me get your attention. Storm, whale, okay, I'm going to bring you back on my team. The other way to get into a storm is to go into it because of obedience. And that's exactly where these guys find themselves. You ever find that to be the case, that when you follow God, life gets harder? This isn't the only story that happens like this. Remember when Moses goes and talks to the children of Israel? Hey, God sent me. We're going to leave Egypt. Yay, go God! And he goes and talks to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, huh, that's what you think. Okay, no more straw for your bricks. They go and talk to Pharaoh and says, what's wrong with you? Beats him up, sends him back out. Moses says, how'd it go, guys? Shut up. But God says, shut up. We're in a worse place now than when we started. I don't even want to hear about your God. But God says in chapter 6, here, tell them this. He said it didn't do any good. They didn't believe because their hearts were broken because of the storm. As Moses began to obey, and he goes before God and says, God, since I started to be obedient, life has gone worse rather than going better. My friend, if you're at that place in life, don't stop now. You're not in an unfamiliar place for the people of God. Oftentimes, when God sends us off, he sends us into a storm. And it's not because you're disobedient. It's because you're obedient. And he knows exactly what you're going to face. What was Jesus doing during this time? End of verse 15. He withdrew again to the mountain by himself. What's he going to do up there? He's going to pray. Again, we find this out from other texts. In fact, in Mark chapter 6, it says he was praying, and as they were making headway painfully, he was watching them. The God who made the storm, who sent the storm, who sent the disciples into the storm, is watching them from his place of prayer as they enter the storm. But from the discipleship side, this feels like absolutely alone. An important point about this miracle that they just witnessed, this is the high point of Jesus' ministry. We talked about that. The effect of this specific event is that they've just gone from the greatest momentum that they've ever experienced as disciples, the high water mark of Jesus' ministry, the high water mark of their own ministry. They see the feeding of the 5,000. Now they're plunged into the valley of despair. Just a note in your spiritual journey, as you experience victory in life, spiritual victories where Jesus is obviously winning in life, be careful for what's right around the next corner, because God frequently sends his disciples from mountaintop to the trough of the waves. And he doesn't do that because he's mean. He doesn't do it because he's vengeful. He does it for our benefit. Well, what benefit is there in this kind of discipleship? Well, let's go back. He sends his disciples to do discipleship alone. But he does this because he's teaching them to expect his presence. Now he sends them off. They can't see him, but he's been watching them the whole time. He's probably on their mind, but they are definitely on his mind. They're wanting Jesus to succeed, and they're feeling like Jesus wants them to fail. But Jesus is wanting them to succeed more than they're wanting to succeed. And so as we turn the corner here, we see that the primary focus of this text is the Savior's initiatives. God is moving through this whole thing. And as he sent these people out to experience the pain, the dark, the wet, the cold, the frustration, the toil, we see that Jesus is going to show up. And when he does, he shows up just on time. When does he show up? Verse 19. Now when they had rowed about 3 or 4 hours, they saw Jesus walking on the sea, coming near the boat. He shows up about the fourth watch. Where does he come? He comes near the boat. The boat, we're told in Matthew 14, is a long way from land. How does Jesus come? Verse 19, he is walking on the sea. He's walking on the sea. How do they react when he arrives? Verse 19, he's walking on the sea, coming near the boat, and they were frightened. They were frightened. I love what one commentator, he says, clearly something extraordinary is happening. The disciples are apparently more afraid of their Savior than they are of the storm. These are fishermen. They're used to wild waters, even at night. They're out on the sea. The thing they can't handle is somebody walking on the sea. Okay? You get it? When God comes to us in the midst of our storm, we'd like him to come in ways that we can expect. Do you ever come to God and you pray, God, here's my storm, and here's how I expect you to fix my storm, right? You come to God, you present your problem, and you have this preconceived idea. So God's going to come, and he's going to fix my problem this way. But he's sovereign, right? He's the king. He's the boss. And he comes to us on his own terms. So when the guys are probably praying and crying out, God, save us, help us with this thing, all of a sudden Jesus shows up, and he comes like walking on the water. It's not the way that they're expecting. And it actually terrifies them, is the word. This is horrific. Yes, we want God, but we don't want him this way. We weren't expecting that. But again, the pictures and the imagery is so closely tied to the previous construction, the previous miracle. He provided bread in the wilderness, like Moses had provided bread in the wilderness. Where did God's people go after going out of Egypt? Into the wilderness, they come to the Red Sea. What does God do with his people at the Red Sea? He makes them to walk through as though on dry ground. And what does Jesus do now? He doesn't walk on dry ground. He walks on dry water, as though it were dry ground. He's walking on top of the waves. What does he say then when he arrives? He says two things. It is I. Now that phrase in particular, there's nothing significant about that phrase. It's how the blind man is going to say, guys, that wasn't somebody else that got healed. It was I. It was me. It's me. Okay, the construction is pretty normal. And yet, in this context, and with the other times where Jesus uses this exact same construction, Jesus is more than just saying, hey guys, it's me, it's Jesus. Jesus is coming to them walking on the water. Okay, walking on the water was a picture that in the Old Testament, only God ever did. Job chapter 9, verse 8, Psalm 77, verse 19. God is the water walker. He makes his footprints through the sea. Only God does this. And when Jesus shows up and they're terrified of Jesus, he says, hold on, guys. I am. And that's the construction. That's what it says. That's what it reads. And when Jesus says, I am, and he's walking on the water, what do you think he means? He means, I am the only one who can do this. I am the water walker. I am the God who controls even the waves. I am. Jesus is making a very definitive statement at this point. The next thing he says is just as important. I am. Do not be afraid. Remember when Peter first realizes who Jesus is? Jesus sends him off after teaching. Jesus sends him out into the deep waters. He throws his net over the boat. He catches this great multitude of fishes. So much he has to get the other boat. So much that both boats begin to sink. And Jesus, Peter turns to Jesus and says, "Get away from me because I am a sinful man." He's terrified. He's terrified. At that moment, Jesus says the same thing that he says just now. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. See, one of the things that storms does is storms reveal our ugliness. Storms reveal our weakness. Storms reveal that we are unprepared. Storms reveal that we are so much unlike our God that we are undeserving of Him. And when Jesus shows up in the middle of the storm, His first word is, "I am God." And if you're not in your right mind, that's not going to do anything. But if you are in your right mind, it's going to terrify you. That's a healthy response. But Jesus has the next response, and He says, "Because I'm this God, don't be afraid. I'm for you, not against you." Jesus sends them out in the lake on purpose. Jesus sends them into the storm on purpose. Because He wants them to know what it feels like to do discipleship alone. They're not, but it feels like they are. And He wants them to learn to expect Him to show up in the midst of the storm. He's going to make a promise. "I will never leave you or forsake you." He wants them to believe it. Even when everything inside of them feels otherwise, He wants them to believe it. So, we're not told here, we're told back in Matthew chapter 14. After Jesus says this, how do they respond? Peter says, "If it is really you, let me walk on the water." And Peter gets out of the boat. You can only imagine. I was trying to see how big waves get on the Sea of Galilee. And they had a video. These are 10-foot waves. They can get up to 10 feet on the Sea of Galilee. That's taller than your boat, all right? Peter says, "If it really is you, let me come and walk on the water. Come on." Gets out of the boat, and he does what nobody other than Jesus has ever said to do. Peter walks on the water. Why? Because Jesus is God. The whole point of this story, my friend, is that they're going to reach their destination. But what he wants us to do is he wants us to understand that it's not just this narrative that is about God. Every storm in your life is absolutely about Him. It's not about you. It's about Him. We take the storms and we say, "You know what? God, I'm in trouble, so help me." And that's not a bad thing to pray. When Peter starts to go down, what does he say? "Lord, save me." But the first word in that sentence is so important. "Lord, save me." Because this storm isn't primarily about you, Peter. This storm is primarily about me. And when you understand who I am, you'll understand where this storm fits in. When you understand where I am, you'll understand where you fit in. And so we come to the last little portion here, the end of verse 21. The first part, it says, they were glad to take him into the boat. And immediately the boat was on land to which they were going. How does this make any sense? How does this wrap up this story in a satisfying way? Doesn't it leave more questions than answers? Well, to some degree. But as we wrap up this text, he wants to encourage disciples, and he wants to challenge us at the same time. How do we know that this took place? Well, who's writing this? John, right? John would have been one of those guys in the boat. We would not know about this if it wasn't for either John telling us here, Matthew telling us, or Peter telling John Mark. Those are three guys who were in the boat, and they wanted disciples who follow after them to understand this. Listen, if you're going to follow Jesus as a disciple of Jesus, I'm telling you, as a disciple of Jesus, this changed our lives. When Jesus came to us in the middle of our storm and he crawled into our boat, you know what happened? We were glad. They experienced overwhelming joy. They were glad to take him into the boat. "Jesus, it's you, and you are God." "Well, Jesus, come into the boat." He made like he was going to walk right by him. But once he they recognize him, and he gives them this greeting, and he gives them this affirmation, he crawls in their boat with them. And when he gets in the boat, they're glad. And haven't you found that to be the case, that in the midst of the storm, God gives you joy? And God gets in your boat, and he gives you joy just by being there. And you know that everything's going to be okay. It's like when you were a kid. And it's like watching The Sound of Music, right? Okay, getting my great repertoire of classics out. And they all go to Marie's room, right? In the middle of the thunderstorm. And the lightning flashes, and what do? They grab their governess. Because as long as she's okay, we're okay. That's what happens with us as children of God, with us as disciples of Christ. When God gets in our boat, we hold on to him. And nothing changes, and yet everything changes. Because he's there. Will, you've been deployed a couple times. You come back. And when the kids grab hold of you, how quickly do they let go? It takes a little while. Because everything's changed. Because Dad's home. Life is going to be different. Life's going to be better. I'm going to be okay. Dad's home. There's joy. And he joins them in the boat. They take him into the boat. He climbs into the very same space, which means he experiences the very same experience that they're experiencing. And then this next phrase is bizarre. We don't know what to do with it. Nobody does. It says, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Well, how did that happen? Was there like hydroplane? Other texts say that the wind ceased. Boom, the wind is done. So we know that they don't have that to contend with. So did they just like, were they close anyway? No, it says they were far away from land. What happened? It seems that Jesus brought them safe to the others. And that's the point. Jesus brings them safe to the other side. They get out on land. The sea didn't destroy them. And there was some question whether or not it might in the middle of the night. But they got there, and they didn't get there by their own efforts. I think that's the point. They didn't get there by their own efforts. God brought them all the way home. So where did they go? Where did they land? They landed at the place to which they were going. Well, up in verse 17, it says Capernaum. In the other texts, it says they were going to Bethsaida. So what we've seen, they're going right up somewhere in here. But both Matthew and Mark say when they landed in Gennesaret. They landed in Gennesaret. Well, wait a minute. Well, they've been pushing to go north. The north wind's been pushing them south. And when Jesus takes them to shore, he lands them here. He lands them on the exact opposite side of the lake. It means everybody who wants to see Jesus is going to have to go up and around the whole thing in order to find him later. But the point is, this wasn't where they were going. Or at least this isn't where they thought they were going. Jesus told them to head this way, but Jesus brings them here when it's all said and done. But you know what? He got them to the place where he wanted them to go because he's sovereign. Sometimes his disciples were disappointed. Things work out, and we get out of the boat, and we say, hey, this isn't where I wanted to be. This isn't what I thought life was going to look like at this point. My wife and I say that to each other. At 50 years old, we thought life was going to look just a little different than this. As a disciple of Jesus Christ, you get out of the boat, and you have a choice. Are you going to be disappointed where he puts you safely? Or are you going to accept this as the next leg of the adventure of discipleship and sovereignty that reveals the goodness of your great God? That's exactly where the story ends. So, what do we do with this? What do we do with this? Well, I want you to look just a little bit farther down the chapter, chapter 6. Go down to verse 68. Down to verse 66. On this other side of the lake over at Gennesaret, people are going to chase Jesus down because of the bread. Jesus is going to explain a little more deeply about the spiritual significance of this bread of life discourse. And then he's going to say, you've got to eat me. and you got to drink my blood. And it's a little harder than what people are expecting. So verse 66, after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. So Jesus said to the 12, do you want to go away as well? Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God. Jesus, you told us out on that sea, you are. You know what? That makes all the difference. We are going to the end, Jesus, with you. Jesus was right. He said, it's going to be safer for you to be in a physical storm where you find out more about me than for you to stay here and join the crowds that want to make me king, because they're chasing me for the wrong reasons. And because Jesus sent them into the storm, their faith is strengthened, and they land exactly where they need to be for the long haul. So what do we do with all this? Takeaway points real quickly this morning. First is this, the one you follow knew what lay ahead, and he's appointed this for you. Do you find yourself in a storm today? Do you find yourself in a storm because of disobedience or obedience? Either way, God knew what lay ahead, and he's appointed this for you. Not against you, for you. Number two is this. The one you follow has been watching and praying for you, and he will come to you to do this with you. He will come to you to do this with you. I love the verse in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Where it says, faithful is he who hath called you, who also will do it. I go back to that over and over and over as a pastor. Because I remind him once in a while, God, I didn't choose to be a pastor. This wasn't what I thought I wanted to do with my life. This is your idea. So I'm going to bank on you doing this because you've called me to do it. Number three, the one you follow will land you in joy and safety, though it may not be where you once thought. You follow the yellow brick road, right? And so you're following the yellow brick road. You think it's going to bring you to the Emerald City. He might have some different destination. At least down here, right? We know where things end, but between here and there, there's any number of landing points. But he will land you safely, period. And he will land you with joy, period. But it may not look like what you're expecting. But that's okay. He's God. It's okay. He's king. It's okay. He's sovereign. And he's good. The last takeaway point this morning is this. The one you follow will use what he's given to you in the process of following him. Why do we have this story? We have this story because disciples found their God to be faithful, and so will you. And so what we did this morning in sharing these testimonies is so important because all of us get scared. All of us find that angst. All of us get bent out of shape by the bubbles of life. And all of us need to find our God to be sufficient in the storms of life. Jesus will not be the king that you're looking for. But he will teach you to look for the king that he is. He's a good king. Will you trust him? Will you trust him? Let's pray.